campaign. So I was delighted when the invitation came. I actually went to work in December. I've forgotten the date. It was sort of near the beginning of December, I guess. Anyway, it was an FOB 7. We had a couple of vacant rooms, no secretaries. Bryce was still in New York. Bill Timmons was there with him. The Congressional Relations Office then consisted of Bryce Harlow, Bill Timmons, and about to come on board, Ken Ballew, and that was it, excepting the secretary assistants that they had at Pierre Hotel, which, if I remember correctly, consisted of Bryce's daughter and Kay Bulow. So I drove my car over to my own place of business, where I had a free garage, or garage paid for, and parked my car and walked on over the FOB 7. Went in, made arrangements for a security clearance. My name had already been cleared there. I needed the badge and a few things like that. And was told that the office would be around the corner, down the hall. I wandered down there and looked at it, and it consisted of one large room and one smaller room. Large room was a good size executive office, normal to this town, and the smaller one was equipped to, could hold about 4 people. It really wasn't equipped. It had, I think, 3 desks in it, and in the bigger office, 1 desk. The telephones were in. There's no stationery, nothing that you could start business with. So and Bill Timmons was due in the next day from New York. And it was my understanding that he was due in with a large quantity of mail. So I went home and picked up several yellow scratch pads and some pencils. Took them down the next morning, parking my car again in the same place that I had, not in the FOB 7, but didn't have a pass for that. In fact, that pass never did come through, but it was all right. I didn't need it. Bill Timmons drove in and laboriously lugged up the elevator about 4 paper cartons, about 2 foot square each, full of mail. Brought them in. We still had no secretarial assistants, although by that time I knew that probably I should hire my own secretary. And I started negotiations with Louise Yarborough, who was still in the White House, who was my secretary in the Navy.
Was she been 4.5 years,
yeah. And, she was then working for an admiral in the Navy, and I had to persuade him to let her go. In the meantime, I borrowed one from the Navy. And he was very generous. Gave me a young lady, and she got over there. But before she got there, Bill and I started to look through these 4 boxes. And my God, there was everything in there. There were letters from senior senators that hadn't been answered. No reason why they should have been. In fact, they couldn't have been. The Pierre Hotel was just a telephone operator's nightmare. I remember we made several files. We tried to get organization. I brought some manila folders in from home. Trade them. I carry them around and organize my own self once in a while. And I had some of them fit into natural ABCs. But there were 2 files we had, which I entitled right away Hot Senate and Hot House. These were letters from senior statesmen, senators, and congressmen that needed a now answer. All of them addressed the president-elect. I thought it was rather inefficient to have to do things that way, but I found out later that it was much more efficient than past history. Past history, these things accumulated in the post office or someplace until after inaugural, and thousands of boxes came over to the White House. Anyway, we made order out of it. Got secretarial assistants in there that afternoon, the next day. Bryce then came down and we worked in FOB 7 until inaugural. Bill Timmons and I made one visit to the White House to look over the rooms we were going to occupy. I occupied Don Rumsfeld now has, Bryce today. I want the salary as of January 21st. I can't answer for the other two gentlemen. You have to ask them.
Well, that's all right.
And so that's a long answer to your question.
Well, no, that gives me some background, and I think that's very helpful in understanding how you got there. There are some very basic questions here I'd like to get through, and then perhaps go into some other more substance and detail. The records of your activities while you were on the staff there, would they be found now in the White House Central Files or still in the Office of Congressional Liaison?
Well, they would be found in both places. I brought no files with me when I left there. Records of the activities, the memorandums of record, the talking papers, all the necessary things that you're now familiar, all the things that you're now familiar with, developed into a procedure. We're not there to start with, of course, but typically a memo to the president would be marked in a manner to indicate sensitivity of information, perhaps administrative confidential. And copies went over to the press and from there sent the files, and we kept copies in our own files.
Do you have an address where you believe you could be reached within, let's say, the next 10 years in the event someone from the Nixon Library wants to come back and talk with you or correspond with you?
Well, you'd have to have the same address I have now, although I don't know if I'll be there 10 years from now.
Some people have given us one fellow told me he was going to be practicing law in Virginia. He said, write the Bar Association there. They'll be able to give you my address 10 years from now. So I've got some wild answers to that.
We've lived here 15 years in this house. I have property in Florida and some property south in Virginia that they've talked about retiring to. I have also property in Oregon. Now, it sounds like I'm property, but they're all small plots. And, my wife and I vacillate. We want to go to Florida, stay in Virginia, go to Oregon.
Well, you've got a nice selection there.
I have.
That's nice. Who has been assigned your responsibilities now that you've left?
Gene Cowan.
Yeah. Right.
And Tom Korologos, who's also in that Senate side.
Are there any magazine or newspaper articles that come to mind that treated the Office of Congressional Liaison and perhaps some of your responsibilities and activities that you might think of now? I've got the National Journal article that was done on the office back in July of last year, I think it was.
Well, of course, there were several newspaper articles, and there were quite a few magazine, U.S. News and World Report, Time, and Newsweek, all reported one time or other on the congressional liaison activity. I have personally some that came to my site because people sent them to me to show them Portland, Oregon or something like that that you wouldn't normally see here. There were quite a few articles during the first 6 months of showing Washington papers. Anybody who wanted to research the Library of Congress obviously have star posts.
We asked this question generally to hopefully find if there's any one or two articles that particularly caught the person's eye in terms of being a good in-depth study analysis. Many cases,
I guess the one you mentioned probably was a good study in-depth. Most of them suffered from lack of complete knowledge.
Well, I think
usually,
this is true.
Usually slanted. Personally, I operate on the basis we should be seen and not heard. Representing the president and the senators wasn't everybody's business, really.
Louise Yarbrough was your secretary for the entire time
you
were over there. Well, getting into the organization of the office itself, it operated under Bryce Harlow, then William Timmons, and then Clark McGregor.
Mm-hmm.
Could you, in a very brief period of time, highlight your responsibilities under each of those three men? Did they change much?
Not really. Under Bryce, until the staff began to be built up, we had Bill Timmons in charge of the House side. Both of us were deputy assistants to the president. I had the Senate. The functions were a little bit different than that in the sense that I had the Armed Services Committees across the board, both houses. That was because of my military background, I guess. And for the Tri-Atomic Energy Committee. And there was some thought about a Space Committee because I'd been staff director of the Senate Space Committee, but when Dale Grubb came in, he handled basically that, although I would talk to select people because of background with him, previous contact, right? When Bryce left and Bill Timmons became assistant to the president, I in fact became the deputy then, and we had hired Gene Cowan in July of 69, if my memory serves correctly, in that time frame, maybe before perhaps, or I've forgotten exactly.
Well,
any event. So I had an assistant, and Dick Cook had been hired by Bill Timmons. The functions remained about the same. And then when Clark came in, they remained about the same, with the exception that as Dick Cook moved more and more in the House and the Senate became a focal point of argumentation, you might say, I had to spend more and more of my time on the Senate. And the atomic energy didn't take much time. Now, there was one period, and that was a period from March until August of 69, where actually I was removed from the Senate liaison, put solely in charge of the ABM program. I reported directly to the president. I didn't report through Bryce, although I kept Bryce informed. And during that period, Dale Grubb acted as bulk of the Senate liaison. I couldn't escape some of it because the mere fact that you were up in the Senate,
right,
dealing with them daily. But I was assigned the direct responsibility for the ABM legislation in the first year with the Defense Department working with me and any of the White House staff. So I reported many times directly to the president and always to Holland, if not to the president, through Holland to the president.
Were there other particular bills that were before the Senate during this time that you worked on that come to mind?
Well, there's
some of the big ones.
There weren't, looking back, I wouldn't say they were big ones. They were routine, but they had hassles attendant to them, excepting the Hainsworth-Carswell nominations, because they were unique to the Senate. Was up above my goulashes in it, you might say, all the time.
I can imagine. Was there any noticeable difference in the emphasis that each of these three men placed upon your various responsibilities? Did one of them say, spend more of your time up on the Hill than down here at the White House, or spend more time with this particular committee head or
minority
leadership?
No, I don't think so. The operation worked pretty much. My relationship with all three gentlemen, of course, I've known Bryce Harlow for a long time. We're close friends, still are, and always will be, but was very free and based on actually mutual trust. It was my decision on where I went when I went to the Senate. There's no real rule that you could have because the senators are all individual. You develop a pattern in life, and I developed because I was well acquainted with many of them. I'd go up and have breakfast or coffee in the Senate dining room two or three times a week, talk with Mike Mansfield or Stennis or Senator Cotton. You learn the pattern, their pattern of going to the office at a certain time. If I wanted to catch Senator Mansfield, I could always catch him at 6:30, 6:45, 7:00 in his private office.
He got up there that early?
Yeah, even as I could Mendel Rivers. He was an early riser. Knock on his door, he'd be there without his secretary, opening mail, looking at it. He'd always eat coffee. Secretary would come in about that time. He'd always say, sit down and have a cup of coffee. Now, if I didn't catch him there, he and John Williams and Senator Aiken and Lola Aikens, or Senator Aikens' wife, always had coffee and maybe donuts in the Senate, in the new Senate office building cafeteria at 8 o'clock sharp. In fact, I could catch them there. I wouldn't intrude on them. It was a private gathering, but if I went over, they would bite me down and sit down. They changed their method of operating, and now they go to the dining room in the Senate proper. I suspect you'll find when you interrogate Cowan and Tom Corologos are following my footprints up there. Now, it used to be, and to digress, but when I was here in the Pentagon years ago, if I wanted to see Carl Benson, I'd catch him at 6:30 in the morning.
That surprises me. I had no idea those people got up there that early to start working.
The result of, you know, long years of habit, I get up at 5 o'clock every morning, and I'm here at 6:45 every morning. I was in the White House at 6:45 constantly, except in the rare morning I'd sleep in.
It makes for a long day.
Yeah, there were 12 to 14 hour days. First 6 months in the White House was almost the first year. The first 6 months, though, were no Sundays or Saturdays at all, steady. I might get off Saturday afternoon or Sunday afternoon, but I was usually there. Right.
Well, now these times when you mentioned you went up to the Hill, were most of your contacts with the senators on a face-to-face basis, let's say more so than by phone?
Well, no, because although I prefer face-to-face discussion if it's on any subject of importance. And you can do that in the Senate and the House. You can't hit to contact all, but you can contact the key members that way, I think. But then by when I said no, I meant they'll call you, of course. So that's a phone contact. Quite often I wouldn't call for appointments. I knew their patterns and habits, and I'd go see them that way. But then there are times when you just do not. We don't have the time to make the personal contact. So I guess if you used a statistical analysis of repetitive incidents of contact, it would be obviously telephone, much heavier. In fact, I've never been in a place that, like the White House for the use of telephone. You literally develop a stiff neck.
Stiff neck and sore ear.
Not stiff neck from policy attitude, but from telephonitis.
This National Journal article quoted one of the people in Congressional Liaison Office as saying that because of events, it wasn't possible really to work on policy. It seemed like what your office was doing more often than not was operational job rather than making policy, I think is the way it was phrased. In other words, you had to respond to events rather than having the luxury of being able to sit down and make plans and prepare for something.
Well, that's, you know, that's a general statement.
Right,
like all general
yes.
statements, it's false to a certain degree. I didn't consider myself a policymaker per se, because you're representing the president on the Hill, and in return you have to represent the senators in the White House. Otherwise, it's got to be a two-way street, because if you're always asking, giving them information, they'll require some consideration of their desires on your part. On the other hand, you make policy by very fact being in that interposition between the executive and the legislative, and you cannot avoid it. Or you influence policy, let's put it that way, because the president is not unaware of their desires, and nor can they be unaware of his. And there's a reaction to that. If you're talking national policy, now if you're talking policy in the office of congressional meetings, I think that obviously any group could have a better policy than they have, humanity not being infallible, but there are many times when we had opportunity to think and discuss, especially under Harlow. We spent long hours at night discussing policy with them. And this wasn't limited to Harlow either. Clark and Bill Timmons and I discussed many things in the generation of legislation if we had the chance. Now, sometimes time overtook you. piece of legislation popped in, or the president had to make a quick decision. We would make no policy, in, for instance, in the selection of a Supreme Court nominee. This would come through Mitchell to the president. The president would either approve or disapprove, and then we went with it. ABM was another example. I don't think we influenced policy. We did a good job of intelligence as to what the Hill's attitude was on it. In fact, I predicted the vote in February or March within one vote of the outcome in August. Total number vote, I made three predictions, and one of them hit it right on the nose, 50-51. I missed three senators in that mishmash. Cannon, Margaret Smith, and let's see which other one I miss. Anyway, I missed three of them.
It's a pretty good record.
That wasn't bad,
no. I'm probably asking the same question, but in a little different light. How much of your time do you think you spent on Capitol Hill overall?
Well, it varied. If you want a national average, I guess I'd have to say 60%. I'm not sure that's too accurate.
Well,
I never
again,
kept book on it.
That's a ballpark figure, and that's all I'm
Sometimes you're up there constantly. I'd get up there in the morning, and I wouldn't get back, but we had a great deal of paperwork in the office, letters from senators that you answer, prepare answers for. But a correspondence section, they did the routine things, but and a tremendous amount of phone calls. We couldn't answer our phone calls to start with. It was just impossible. We finally got the point. I got the point where I'd finish up my phone calls before I left tonight, or I might have one or two the next morning, but I'd always get back within 24 hours. But the first two or three months, it was impossible. Everybody, the reason was, the cabinet was new. The Hill people didn't know the cabinet, didn't know the people around them, but they knew the White House, and they knew Rice, and they knew me. And they knew Timmons. And so they'd call us saying, hey, what in the heck do we do on this interior thing? And the situation was complicated because, or compounded rather, because the White House staff wasn't as well organized or oiled, if you please, as it is now, and we didn't know each other. So to seek information, one call from the Hill, I figured out, generated six calls on mine before I could call back. So if you had 50 calls in a day, you had 50 times six. And that's what I mean by this telephonitis. I'm not kidding you, the phone call just, there'd be some days I wouldn't get on the Hill, I'd just be on the phone all day long. So, and I couldn't dictate, and the secretaries couldn't take dictation, they were also on the phone. So I finally got a machine, and I'd get in there at 6:45, and I'd have, as I have here, a basket called action, note, signature. I had one folder marked dictation, and I'd start dictating at about, not 7:15, but 6:45, between that and 7 o'clock. Dictate for 45 minutes, clean my desk of that stuff, then spend the rest of the day on the Hill, either dictate that night or the next morning. That went on day after day.
Sounds like an impossible job.
Well, it straightened out. It became a pattern developed after a while. It's not that anymore.
Would it be fair to say that you spent most of your time when you were in direct contact with the Senate, with the minority leadership, majority leadership, the chairman of various committees, specifically the ones that you were most interested in, or was it senators across the board?
I'd guess, generally on a big issue, you first talk to the leaders, and then you talk across the board when you're trying to glean votes. And we had a format that I wrote out on voting, which pretty soon, like a pitcher on a baseball team, you learn the voting habits. You could come up on any given issue just about and come within 20 or 30 votes of what the final was going to be, and then you'd start cleaning that up. And in a few hours, or sometimes you were lucky sometimes to catch up with, make contact, a day or so you knew. You'd have firm votes for, firm votes against, undecided, and leaning in one direction or the other. And that gave you what we began to call target lists. And you know how many out of 100 votes, it's very easy then to see how many you have to get at the target list to win.
These that were undecided or on the fence, would it be your responsibility then and yours alone to get in touch with those people?
No.
Or would you be calling various agencies that
have
interest in it?
Utilize all the resources of the executive branch. I guess a typical example would be, well, first, we established a policy early that the White House staff itself could never be big enough to do the whole job. Rather handle the policy and have the departments do the, in harness, the actual horses on the wagon. But that didn't preclude, and in fact, it still required that the White House make contact with the leaders. Now, you asked a question a while ago about which ones did you spend most of your time with? I'd guess most of the time was spent with the key people, the chairman, the majority and minority leaders, and their subordinates down the line. The Democratic Party is organized differently in the Senate than the Republicans. Republicans have 5 leaders, the Democrats have a more monolithic structure with the majority leader. But even then, Mike Mansfield didn't speak for all the Democrats, so and all the rest of you knew the pattern. Each issue had its own chairman, its own senior Republican, and then they didn't always follow party lines by any means. Fact is, Mr. Nixon has had pretty good success in his legislative programs, considering he's had a minority position in the Senate and House, and that means that you had to get the votes to win other than the Republican group. On the conservative issue, we could generally depend on a minimum, I guess, of 12 Republican senators to vote against a conservative issue, if there be a definition for a conservative issue. And 18 Democrats to vote for it. Now, this fluctuated a little bit, but that, as a rule of thumb, sort of gave you your plimsoll mark, if you please, or your base point on which to start your survey. And I spent, because I had a working knowledge of most of the Democrats, I'd really sort of reconnaissance in Democratic point of view. I'd go back to Hugh Scott or to Dirksen. And I'd quite often spend maybe every evening for a week or 2 weeks in Dirksen's office, where the Republicans kind of came in and out talking, and we'd organize key people to, when you could, if they were willing, and you can't order them from the executive side, to be spearhead for your argument on the floor. And if a cabinet officer knew somebody or had was part of the program, he would utilize his people. Of course, each department has its own legislative liaison, so we use that as a technical chain of information and command.
So you would be in contact with these people at various agencies?
Oh yes, all the times, on the phone. We had meetings, not regular meetings, but we had meetings usually on Saturdays or Fridays with the legislative liaison types of each department.
Would this be one big meeting?
Mm-hmm.
Or would you
use it? Well, we did it two ways. We divided our office up into functions on certain types of bills. So Gene Cowan had certain types, I had certain types, when Tom Corbett came, he had certain types. Same thing in the House, was a little bit differently organized, but the principles are the same. And then we organized them in functional areas as well. For instance, I consistently had defense, so I'd have a defense man over maybe 2 or 3 others, and we had them by groups as well. And defense and state, I had most of the state stuff from my hands, from the Senate, and some in the House. For a while until Dick Cook got in there. And so Dave Abshire and the state be on the phone to them constantly, working closely with Kissinger's office on those issues, of course.
Did you have much contact with lobbyists for various special interest or private interest groups? Did these people get into the act?
Well, they always do. I didn't. Accepting in the ABM phase. Chuck Colson was hired for the purpose of contacting outside government groups. during the ABM phase and subsequently on defense majors, mainly, where you have natural lobbyists or interested groups such as the Veterans of Foreign Wars, American Legion, etc. But you didn't really have to contact them. They'd contact you if they had an interest in something. Sometimes they worked for us, sometimes they didn't. Organized labor was for us constantly on defense issues and against us. Obviously on the Haynesworth-Carsman fit and other issues.
But more often than not, then their communications to the White House would be directed to Chuck Colson rather than to congressional liaison.
After Chuck came in the office, yes. Although there's no clean line on that quite often. The whole White House has to utilize the talents of the people. Know somebody or they're especially talented, capable for a given job.
Did you have much contact with the administrative aides for senators, or were you working on the senators themselves directly rather than?
That varied from office to office. The general answer would be mostly with the senators. It's impossible for one or two people to contact, be in constant contact with a senator and his aides, because each senator has an administrative assistant and a legislative assistant. 100 senators plus two is 300. We've got 500, 435 House members. So that's 3 times 435, add that to the 300. Then take your committee members and their staff, directors and minority members, and it's just you've got almost 2,000 people. White House staff, 5, 6, or 7 people can't do that. So you found out which ones were the ones that were the movers. And in certain senators' office, I could do just as well. But if I want to give a message to a senator and get a senator's viewpoint, I knew which ones I could talk to, which would speak for the senator and be fixed, I guess, honorable, and you knew you were getting the truth.
Right.
Some senators don't work through their administrative assistants. One senator, I'd only worked through his assistant, a lady, only for appointments. He didn't want to talk substance through her, talk to me. So it was on a case-by-case basis, basically.
I understand you attended on a regular basis the congressional leadership meetings and the bipartisan leadership meetings.
That's right. Yeah.
What was your role with these? Were you a participant, a note taker, a consultant?
Well, so basically, just there as a need to know basis, because the senators were there. Sometimes as a note taker, and you'll find memoranda on the file for the meetings that I attended. In the early days, generally we kept more note-taking on a memorandum for record following an individual senator's meeting if there was substance that the president needed to remember conclusions from the meeting. But you want to make a matter of record. Basically on a need to know the information that was both imparted and their reaction to it, which is the most important thing, I believe. Because it would be fatal for your representatives or mine to go up on the hill and talk to people after you and I have been meeting with them and we don't know what the conversation was, you see. It's simply that. And there's a very key thing here for a future historian or a future president to look at. If the president doesn't give the impression, at least, that he gives honor to his representatives, that his representative will gain no honor and not be properly received.
And I understand that, just in this specific case, the senator, it doesn't take him long to discover whether or not this person that supposedly represents the president.
Oh, no, this is their business, and they're very knowledgeable. And the fact is, we can easily recognize in society an expert as an engineer or a mathematician. Believe you me, one of these senior senators who's been here a while can walk into a room of 1,000 people and in 5 minutes know what they're thinking about and how to address them. which is just as much expertise as knowing how to survey a line through the forest.
Were there other White House staffers that you worked with on a pretty much a regular and constant basis? You mentioned.
Well, you worked with all of them. Yes, you worked with some of them on a regular basis.
Well, I think there's only about one more question. Oh, as far as the other White House staffers that you worked with on a constant basis.
On a regular basis, of course, Haldeman and Ziegler. And then, depending on the issue, could be Gifford and Schultz's offices, really on Timmons' payroll. But he works for Bob Schultz. He was liaison between OMBE when OMBE became OMB when it became came into existence. But Ken Cole, Ehrlichman, Flanagan, lots of dealings with Flanagan. It depended on the cyclic rate of fire legislation, et cetera, because each one might go to a different segment of the White House. If it pertained to defense, when I was there, Jim Schlesinger, and he's just recently gone to AEC, if I had a budgetary query or budgetary White House thing that we want to portray in Hill, I'd guess that a great percentage of my time was with the Kissinger, Al Haig, Chop. But it depended which White House staff had an interest in it, then you went in that direction.
We asked this question in order to, perhaps at some point it would be possible to see the lines of communication in the White House, if in fact you can come up with anything.
Well, I think a pattern definitely developed. In the first formative months, it was sort of like cops and robbers. You had to get acquainted with each other, develop their own procedures. There's no book on the subject, and each president's different. This is one of the tedious things of working in the White House, also one of the fascinating facets of it. But it has a logical pattern. The White House is much more formally structured, in my opinion, than it has been, was under Ike, under Kennedy, and Johnson. I had some knowledge of all three prior ones.
Well, one last question we ask, it elicits wide variety of replies, and that is, what do you think was the most satisfying aspect of your assignment or job? We've gotten general replies, we've gotten specific replies to that question.
Well, specifically, of course, when you talk, when you win a vote.
Would there be any special vote
closely
against
tomorrow? Contested one. Of course, the ABM one would have been the first one. More recent vote on the Mansfield-NATO amendment, which was going all in one direction and turned around after the president went to the country. But he began to understand, really, these, usually people ask how many arms do you twist? The answer to that surprised a few people, because you can't twist arms in that business and stay in it. You twist a man's arm real hard once and you don't go back to it. So the arguments basically have to stand on their own merits. Now, the merits are not what the average man in the street thinks sometimes, because a senator might vote against something or for it because of a local interest. It may be rightly so. The White House is looking for the whole world picture, and he's looking a little different. And there are partisan considerations too, obviously. But outside of specific votes, defeats are the wins. We had more wins than we had. I think we owned at least 51% of stock most of the time. I enjoyed the job more on a general basis. I enjoyed the personal contact with the senators. I knew a lot of them. It was fun working back and forth. I enjoyed the White House staff. We had lots of major arguments, but you're at a point where problems haven't been solved before, maybe aren't, and you're trying your damnedest to do it. We had some lulus of arguments with the White House staff. Some lulus of arguments on the hills too, but on the hill too. But
I think I'd be a little bit puzzled and suspicious. I think if you didn't have arguments again, because the problems are of such import.
No one solved them, and maybe never will. All you do is make your little niche or notch. You bend the light ray a little bit so it illuminates the picture more, perhaps. I don't know. And you work out to your salvation with fear and trembling, somewhat, as the Bible says. And really, in that business, I don't want to wax biblical too much. Well, why not? As a man thinketh, so is he, is absolutely correct. That's what a person thinks, causes him to vote to a certain way.
The only question that I have that remains, and it's a question that puzzles me personally, is how is it possible for the staff that you had to ride herd on all of the legislation? Is it a case of saying, well, now there is some legislation that's more equal than other?
Well, you don't. Obviously, you don't on all the legislation, because there are thousands of bills every
year. Well,
this
is...
But again, going back to this business of the White House, should not try to control everything and do everything. You'd be centralized to the point of just asphyxiation, if nothing else. Each department has a legislative relations, or they usually call it legislative relations, legislative affairs, congressional relations. I get them all mixed up because we've used them all interchangeably. I guess congressional relations is a little better than congressional affairs, but sometimes I wonder.
That
might be more appropriate. Let's take a defense appropriation bill now. White House staff couldn't, and the president makes a determination on the forces he wants somewhere along the line. You can't expect the White House to get up there and argue on every little tank and every little thing, unless it be the salient feature or something. And so you pick the key ones. And this is where you should put the White House effort. If you put too much White House, you get overkill. Mm-hmm. Or also the fact that you knock on the man's door too often, you lose your effectiveness. Mm-hmm. But in the beginning days, when the departments were new, I think it's going to happen to any administration. A new president brings in his cabinet members. They're new. It's the old staff that's there don't know them yet, and there's a lack of connection, lack of rapport. They don't rap with each other as they should. After a while now, it's old shoe. I pick up the phone and call. Generally know in the White House when I was there who was doing what to whom, and I could call up and get the guy within one or two phone calls. I knew the answer. And in government, but the first 6 months it takes you. So I said 6 phone calls, maybe more. But you don't answer. You don't try to cover them all. The departments carry the little ones. It's sort of like the biblical expression again. Moses, when the children of Israel got kind of fed up and they said, who's running this outfit? So we got them all together and divided captains over tens, captains hundreds, captains over thousands, it says in Leviticus. The little problems they solved themselves, the big ones they took to Moses. So.
Well, that's a very apt way of describing
that.
The way you resolve those things.
It's in Mooney's book on organization, which is one of the best books written on organization principles.
Well, I've taken up far more of your time than I should have, and I apologize.
Well, you're more than welcome, Terry. I'm sorry we couldn't do it.
Well, hopefully, at some point when after the Nixon administration leaves office, we may be around knocking on your door again, asking for another opportunity to sit down and talk with you in more detail.
Well, you'd be more than welcome. I would have had you over in the office when I was there, and couldn't do it because
well,
I kept tied up in the move here, and just couldn't.
Well, I sat out there and I just got goose pimples sitting there thinking, my God, I'm going to go in there and talk to the gentleman that's Undersecretary of the Army. It just scares me to death.
Don't you worry about that.
No, it's an honor on my part, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. I hope the questions I asked were...
I'm glad that we had a free afternoon. This is the schedule here for up through next week.
Doesn't look like your load has lightened any since you left.
No, well, it's heavier now than it was there. It's about like it was first in the White House. I mean, we'll stay that way for about a month. Although I'm getting to the point where I can control the schedule. For instance, tomorrow I just cancel all the afternoon schedule so I can start over again and do what I want to.
Gosh.